I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a highly recommended summer read. But first, what's caused the price of eggs to rise 34% in the U.S. in the past year, the price of vegetable oil to go up 47% in Botswana? A new report from the United Nations says the increasing demand for crop-based biofuels is a major reason food prices are soaring worldwide, and world leaders meeting at a food summit in Rome next week are expected to tell U.S. officials the same thing. John Ward Anderson is foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, based in Paris. John, first of all, give us a sense of the scope of this, because every country has been affected.
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. Food prices have gone up 20% in China, between 11 and 14% in Indonesia, South Africa, Egypt, 18% in Pakistan. And really, no country has avoided the food increases. As you said, these prices are being felt all around the world.
Well, and what did the UN say? How did they project out how long the food prices might be high?
Well, they said that basically because of some short-term anomalies, and really what they were talking about there were drought, that they felt that this huge spike increase, this record rise in food prices recently, is going to moderate, but that over the long term, over the course of the next 10 years, that prices are still going to be much higher than they have been, for instance, in the last 10 years.
And there are other factors. You mentioned weather. There's also an increased demand for food from growing developing countries. But the co-author of the report, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, says 33% of the expected rise in food prices over the next decade can be tied directly to biofuels. Now, these are made largely from corn here in the U.S., other crops worldwide. What did the OECD conclude about biofuels?
Well, they said that basically the benefits of biofuels were being overstated. They've got reports, two separate reports that are coming out over the course of the next couple of months, in which they say they've got data that's going to show that the cost of biofuels is simply too high. And one of the costs is the one you just mentioned. Fully one-third of the rise in all food prices over the next 10 years they expect to be from the increased demand for biofuels.
Because if corn is going into biofuels and a feed is another problem, it's not going into the mouths of hungry people.
Exactly. When you've got agricultural products that previously were going to food or were going to livestock feed being put into producing fuel instead, it reduces the supply of food and it increases the demand for those food products, so the prices go up.
And, of course, critics of this thinking say we've got to do something to supplement oil and just, you know, perhaps switch away from corn, use another product. But biofuels are essential. You know, how is this debate unfolding?
Well, I mean, what they're saying is that the reason that the demand for biofuels is so high right now is because the price of oil is so high. I mean, the price of oil now is spiking upwards of $135 a barrel. And when it costs that much to buy oil from the ground, then suddenly the cost of producing fuel from agricultural products suddenly looks a lot cheaper. So the demand is very high. They're talking about 40% of the corn products over the next decade in the United States going into fuel instead of into food and livestock feed, which means that the price of dairy products is going to go up, the price of poultry is going to go up, the price of meat is going to go up, everything is going to rise because of it.
And critics of corn-based biofuels have long said that there's so much energy used in the production of biofuels that it's not worth it, things like ethanol. But this now becomes a political issue because, you know, this is helping farmers in the U.S. How heated do you expect this meeting to be next week?
But it's not just the United States. I mean, Europe is also into biofuels heavily, and a lot of places are. Not only that, but, you know, a lot of less developed countries have been looking at the biofuels market and have been taking their land and setting increasing amount of it aside for the production of biofuels. And now, you know, if they come out at this World Food Summit next week and start taking pot shots at the production of biofuels, it could get to be a very heated debate.
We understand one of the plan Bs that the report recommends is the increased use of genetically modified seeds. But that's a controversial issue as well.
Well, exactly. But it's not just genetically modified seeds. They said that was one thing that the world ought to be looking at. In essence, one of the main messages was that the world needs to, when it looks at development programs, it needs to go back to the idea of putting more money in agriculture, not just genetically modified seeds, but also technology transfers to less developed countries, increasing irrigation and fertilization products and things of that nature.
Get back to farming.
to put more money back into agricultural development.
Yeah. John Ward Anderson, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Robin, it's good to talk to you.
Well, listener Gregory Alwyn recently wrote a very nice note pointing out that I should say reprise instead of reprise in meaning a repeat. So here goes. Today we have a reprise of a favorite story. It's the true story of a girl in New Hampshire in the 60s shunned by her community when she becomes pregnant. Author Meredith Hall was just 16, a good girl from a good family, suddenly ruptured by her parents' painful divorce. Meredith was kicked out of school, shunned by her family, in shock. She ultimately allowed her newborn baby to be taken from her without putting up a fight.
I struggle to reckon with my own silence, my lack of fight. I allowed my family and community to abandon me when I was drowning. Worst of all, I allowed my baby to be abandoned. I never said a word. Sometimes my own failure of courage feels like the most hideous kind of cowardice, a flaw in me that confirms my unworthiness for love. Sometimes, rarely, I get a flicker of understanding and feel a powerful protectiveness of that stunned and desperate girl. It is a function of shunning that it must eliminate the shunned completely. It feels like a murder and is baffling because there is no grave. No hymns were sung to ease my going or to beg for God's blessing on my soul. Shunning is as precise as a scalpel, an absolute excision, leaving, miraculously, not a trace of a scar on the community body. The scarring is left for the girl, an intense, debilitating wound that weeps for the rest of her life. It's quite a price to pay for having scared sex on a beach on a foggy Labor Day night.
Without a Map is Meredith Hall's memoir, dredging up the deprivation and grief she dragged around for decades until a surprise ending. It's now out in paperback. When we first spoke, we asked Meredith to tell us about the girl she once was.
I think that I was a girl who wanted to follow the rules. I wanted approval. I wanted to be a good girl. And I got that approval from my mother and certainly from my church and my school. I was an excellent student. I was accustomed to doing well. I came from a family that had not attended college. I believed that I was going to be the first generation and go to an excellent school, and that would open the door to my future. Mm. And things went terribly wrong.
They did. But before that, I mean, I'm thinking of your mother as well, creating this home for you. You sewed together. She taught you how to sew. That really stuck with me, you know, that everything seemed perfect. And then the day that you come home, kicked out of school, and tell your mother, and she says what?
I had gone to school that morning. I was 4.5 months pregnant and trying to hide one more day, and the school nurse finally caught me out and pulled me aside, and I was expelled, as girls were in the mid-60s. I was terrified, but I still didn't know exactly what I was expecting was going to happen.
Right.
My mother came home, and she told me to call my father, and he came over from his house. By the end of that conversation, it was clear that we were going to give up the baby, although I was not consulted on that. And my father asked my mother, "Now what?" And my mother said, "Well, she can't stay here." And
that, now that moment explodes off the page. What's happening in your young head?
There was a very dramatic severing that happened for me at that moment. And my mother's response was a complete surprise to me. I knew enough not to tell her, but I don't know what I thought she was going to do. Certainly, I didn't expect that she was going to kick me out. Mm-hmm. And I didn't expect that my father would take me in. He had remarried, and I did not have a relationship with him or his wife.
It wasn't exactly the best option. You were just kept in a room in this house while your dad and his new wife traveled, did their work. Right. You were some terrible embarrassment that was hidden away.
Yes. I think that I was typical of a girl in 1965. We brought so much shame to the family that we were, in fact, sent away and hidden away. Of course, I didn't know that. I didn't know that there was any other girl in the world who was in my situation or had done what I had done was as shameful as I was. What I knew was that everything I had known was gone now.
What were you feeling from people, from friends? You know, people were crossing the street if you saw them, not to see you.
Yes, there was a great community shunning, and it's quite a phenomenon. There was no one who stepped forward and said, I will not behave in that way.
Worse than that, there is a doctor who pretty much said, you know, you're a bad girl.
Yes, he did. He said very clearly, you're a bad girl, and don't you try to tell me who the father of this baby is. We know that girls like you never know. It was a very, very... And he treated me and my body through that pregnancy and delivery with just that message, that I was so filthy and so contaminated that I deserved really nothing from him.
You then go off on this numb journey without a map, as the book says. You have one or two relationships, attempt to go to college, and end up deciding to walk from Britain to India. And it's this sort of biblical, you end up barefoot, starving, mute, because you don't speak the language, in the middle of Lebanon. What was that about?
It was a very reckless act. A friend of mine calls it my suicide walk. And in many ways, you know, by then, this was a few years. My child was 5 years old by the time this happened.
And by the way, you're thinking that every day. You're thinking, how old is my child?
How old is my child and where is my child? Mm-hmm. But by now, I had lost my mother's love and protection. And I had lost this baby into this great void, this absolute silence, as if none of it had ever happened and as if he didn't exist. And then along the way, because of trouble with my stepmother, I was forbidden when I was 19 years old to ever return to my father's home. And it was that final abandonment that really pushed me, I think, over the edge into this recklessness. And I left on that wandering feeling that there was absolutely nothing that could harm me. I was not afraid of anything.
Well, and you might have been guarded by something, because it's astonishing you weren't harmed. Here you are, this blonde American. You are fed from a goat by one Arab. A woman who is breastfeeding a child calls you over and gives you some of her milk.
Right. When I wrote that chapter, a friend commented afterwards when she read it, I love the way milk is working in this chapter.
Well, you were looking for a mother.
And I was astonished. I had no idea that I had written milk into the chapter. And I see now that, in fact, I had discovered both the father's love, this old shepherd who offered me sustenance and kindness, and then the mother's milk. I see why these are memories that I've carried with me all these years.
That's author Meredith Hall. Her memoir, Without a Map, is now out in paperback. It tells of her struggle as a teenager forced to give up a child for adoption. In a minute, what happened to that child? And later, by the way, what will the Democrats do about those delegates from Michigan and Florida? Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with Meredith Hall. She tells the story of being pregnant and 16 years old in the 60s in her memoir, Without a Map, which is now out in paperback. She was forced to give up her baby for adoption. Now, her story is a reminder that for many young, frightened girls, adoption is a lifesaver. It means someone will raise the child they can't. But for Meredith, it wasn't even a choice. She was simply told her son would have a better life. Did he? Well, more than two decades later, when Meredith was raising two other children living a normal life, suddenly, out of nowhere, someone knocks on her door. A 21-year-old named Paul enters her life. We asked what it was like to finally meet her first son.
I think every girl who gives up a baby into adoption waits and believes that they're going to find this child, that somehow this child is going to return to their lives. But in that time, a girl was told that she absolutely must never contact this child, that she would destroy the child. It would be the ultimate. Not only did you do this horrible thing in having this child, but it would be the worst kind of betrayal and harm to try to find the child. And so I didn't do that, and I regret it very much. In fact, My son, when he was 21, worked through the New Hampshire court system and was given access to me, and he did come and find me, and we forged a relationship. I had two younger sons, significantly younger, and he has had the courage to join our family.
And you forged this wonderful relationship. He's determined to have you in his life, even though it's painful for him to see that you have these two other children and he didn't have the life they had. And it's excruciating for you to discover that this boy that you dreamed was on a horse farm somewhere in Virginia, as the doctor told you, back to the doctor, had a terrible life of abuse, poverty.
In fact, he was adopted. This was a private adoption, so my doctor had full control over these decisions. And he allowed my baby to be adopted by a couple in my father's small New Hampshire
town. He's right there.
He was right there. And it was a very, very difficult life for my son. There was abuse and extreme poverty, and it was a very, very bad environment for him.
Yeah, you get to know this family and forgive them. An abusive father who didn't know any other way. They were French-Canadian, I think,
yes.
And they were farmers.
Right.
They both came from huge families. They were not educated. They were sort of acting out the stories that had been in their families.
Right.
And your son, when he was small, was beaten. He worked.
Yes, he was. He was overworked, worked like a man, worked hard on this very, very poor farm.
His mother couldn't protect him?
No, his mother loved him very, very much, but she was not able to protect her children. And by the time I met them, my son's adopted father had changed and was a kind of beaten old man. And his mother was filled with regret. And we did forge a very kind and tender relationship built on our mutual failures to this child. Hmm. We all failed this child.
Hmm. Did he say to you, why did you give me up? I mean, was it that clear?
No, never why did you give me up, but there was certainly a lot of searching for identity because the life he would have lived with me would have been so different from the life that he actually lived. So there was a lot of questioning for him of what the implications are, how is identity formed, and what does it mean that he was dropped into this very, very strange family environment that was deeply formative for him. Mm-hmm.
Running parallel to this is another story. You, as you said, became a mother, and then a mother to your mother. Your mother starts dying a very painful death from
multiple sclerosis.
And you make note of a certain point that she had become so needy that the time had passed for any kind of reckoning of what had happened between the two of you. So you never had that kind of. How could you do that to me?
No, and I waited, you know. I became her caregiver along with my siblings when she got the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. I was in my early 20s. And so this was a dramatic shift. We had come through this very bad time and had certainly not spoken of it, let alone resolved it. And suddenly here she was with multiple sclerosis, and I understood immediately that she was dying and that I needed to step in and be a good daughter. Well, it took many, many, many years for her to die of multiple sclerosis, which I didn't know. It gave us plenty of time to undo some of that harm and make it right. And that never happened. We became very close, and I loved her very much, and I felt loved by her, but she never again felt like my mother. That ended the moment she told me to leave the house when I was 16 and in such trouble. I tried to be deeply caring and deeply protective, but I felt angry, and I had to wrestle with that throughout her illness, waiting for her to step forward and make this right in some way, to mention it even, to bring it up and say, maybe I didn't handle that in the way I should have. But it never did come up.
And your father, you had one meeting with him in a parking lot.
Yes.
Do you forgive them? Do you understand why they did it?
Yes. I think that forgiveness is very tricky territory because it suggests a victim, and that victim coming back with some sort of grand gesture and bestowing something from the heart, and I'm very uncomfortable with it. Mm. I think instead the process for me has been one of recognizing human imperfection, and that love can be deep and even profound and still fail us. So the process for me has been one of understanding that those failures of love, in spite of costing me a great deal, are in fact the structure, they're the webbing of my life. Hmm.
Did they ever get to meet their grandchild, your oldest son?
Yes, they both did, in fact, meet him. And there was some measure of welcoming on the part of both of them. Perhaps not perfect, but some.
Of their loss?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Meredith Hall's memoir is Without a Map. It's now out in paperback. Next week on Here and Now, a new film follows a former Catholic priest as he traces the history of anti-Semitism from Constantine's sword to the U.S. Air Force. That's next week. Back after the news, Here and Now. They're coming on buses, they're taking the train, they're metroing, referring to Washington subways. That's how one organizer described Hillary Clinton supporters traveling to Washington to demonstrate today and tomorrow as the Democratic Party's Rules Committee meets to decide what to do about seating those delegates from Florida and Michigan. The party voided the state's results after they moved up their primaries in violation of party rules. Well, Christine Samuelson of Newton, Massachusetts, is going to D.C. with countthevotescast.org. Christine, other Democrats say the party has to have a way to discipline states. Make your case that these votes should count.
Number one, in Florida, it was the Republican governor and legislature that set the date of the election. So why should all those 1.7 million voters in Florida be punished for something they didn't have control over?
Is it worth the national image, once again, of Democrats fighting?
I don't think having two good candidates go to the convention is a fight. I don't think that's a bad fight to have.
You want Clinton and Obama to go all the way to the convention in August?
Sure. I guess either one of them could be strong, except I don't believe that if Obama's the nominee, that he can beat McCain. The caucus delegates that Barack Obama has won are not representative of the people as much as a primary election is. People with children at home or an elderly person at home or the elderly themselves or working class people cannot spend the time at a caucus. I think the primary votes are much more representative of the people, and I believe that Hillary Clinton has stronger support in the nation.
You know, much has been made of how Barack Obama supporters might react if, in fact, he does not get the nomination. Will you take it personally if Hillary Clinton isn't nominated?
What I have taken personally is how she has been treated in the press and by Democrats. I'm just floored by the sexism. I know there's a movement this week of people sending shoes to the DNC meeting. They're supposed to be piling up there at the hotel for tomorrow.
Why shoes?
It's just to have your boots on the ground, so to speak. If you can't be there, you're sending a pair of shoes to represent you. Now, if those were shoes arriving for Barack Obama's campaign, I believe the press would be there covering it. I think they've written her out. The DNC is letting the press nominate the Democratic nominee.
Christine Samuelson from Newton, Massachusetts, on her way to a demonstration outside the Democratic Party's Rules Committee meeting. Christine, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's turn to John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, political writer for The New York Times. John, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? There's going to be a lot of people demonstrating outside that meeting.
There'll be a big ruckus. I expect that at the end of the day, and probably by the end of Saturday, that the Rules and Bylaws Committee is going to divide the delegates in a way favorable to Hillary Clinton, but not so favorable that it threatens in any serious way Barack Obama's grip on the nomination. That would be the last remaining impediment to the superdelegates once the primaries are finished on Tuesday, coming down, making a decision as Democratic leaders are urging them to, and I suspect that would quickly produce a verdict for Barack Obama.
Well, the Obama campaign has been asking its supporters, to not show up for a counter demonstration outside the Rules Committee meeting tomorrow. Is that because that campaign can afford to be somewhat magnanimous? They are ahead something like 200 delegates, so that divide in the Florida-Michigan delegates would not threaten the Obama campaign.
Well, not only can they afford to be magnanimous, they also have a strategic interest in turning down the volume, turning down the temperature, avoiding any kind of a lasting fissure in the party. And I think that notwithstanding the closeness and duration of this race, there still isn't deep and bitter feuding among Democrats. Remember, Robin, this is not ideological. This is not about a cause for either one, really, in the largest sense. They've both been campaigning as mainstream candidates. It's really a personal fight that Barack Obama, who would be the first African-American president, is winning, and Hillary Clinton, who'd be the first woman president, is losing, narrowly, but nonetheless losing.
Well, I just want to pick up on something that Christine Samuelson just said, the Clinton supporter, that, you know, she believes that Hillary Clinton has more popular support, that while Obama won in the caucuses, it's quite different from winning in the primaries in the general election. How much is that an issue in Democratic circles?
Well, the Clinton campaign is trying to make that argument by pointing to the popular vote, and that's one of the reasons they want to get Florida and Michigan delegates seated so that they can then point to the primary results and say, look, she got more popular votes than Barack Obama. But if you look at national opinion polls of Democrats, Barack Obama now has a healthy lead over Hillary Clinton. So it's a difficult argument for them to sustain. And, of course, the bottom line is that this is a race decided by delegates under the rules, and Barack Obama has a lead on that metric, which is the one that really counts.
Big drama this week in Washington, of course, from former Bush White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan's book. McClellan saying he came to see that Iraq was an unnecessary war. The White House waged the war as a campaign. How much does this impact John McCain, who's made his political stand on supporting the war?
Well, I think it doesn't change anything dramatically, but it does, to some marginal degree, steepen the hill that John McCain faces. You now have a person at the innermost circle of Texans around President Bush saying that, A, we made a serious blunder, and B, we manipulated the facts in order to make sure that we got our way. That serves to undercut John McCain's argument and strengthen Barack Obama's. This follows after a similar memoir was done involving Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, who said the same thing about the push for tax cuts. And so on the principal foreign policy and domestic policy initiatives of President Bush, you have people very close to those situations saying it was a mistake, they didn't listen to the facts, and that's a problem for John McCain.
The difference, of course, between O'Neill and McClellan is that O'Neill began saying those things while he was in the White House, you know, before he got pushed out.
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons he got fired.
Right. Whereas the Bush White House is pretty much beating up on Scott McClellan, you know, trying to diminish his thoughts now by saying he didn't say them before. So, you know, is that dust up going to, you know, really take what some say is a Republican campaign off track, further off track?
Well, the White House is going to do whatever they can to scuff up Scott McClellan, because it hurts when someone very close to the inner circle says things like that. But look, the American people are already inclined to believe what Scott McClellan is saying, so the White House has got the short side of that argument.
Well, there have been some top Republicans also sort of hand-wringing about John McCain's campaign being off tracks, you know, a general feeling that he's sort of blown this opportunity while Obama and Clinton are fighting it out.
Well, to some degree, John McCain has been paying the price now for the disarray in his campaign some time ago. Remember, in 2007, he was flat on his back. He had almost no money. He lost a lot of his campaign staff, and nevertheless, improbably ended up as the nominee. And so they're trying to make up for lost time. A lot of Republicans look at that fact and this very daunting political climate with people unhappy about the economy and the war and President Bush and are impatient for John McCain to show more progress. But he's got a lot of work to do before November.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, political writer for The New York Times, and author of Pennsylvania Avenue: Profiles in Backroom Power. Thanks as always.
You bet.
And in just about 5 minutes, Hayes Carl, a little bit country, a little bit Bob Dylan. You're listening to Here and Now. Is it high art or child pornography. That's a debate in Australia after officials there shut down an exhibit of one of the country's most famous artists because the exhibit features photographs of naked 12 and 13-year-old girls. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd called the exhibit by photographer Bill Henson absolutely revolting, but the Australian arts community, including Oscar-winning actress Cate Blanchett, signed an open letter saying his work is part of an artistic tradition that stretches back to the ancient Greeks. Well, joining us with more is Hamish Fitzsimmons. He's a reporter for the 7:30 Report on Australia's ABC TV. And Hamish, first of all, how big an issue is this in Australia?
It's been quite an issue this week. This has been the first real hurdle that this new government has had to face, especially given the fact that Kevin Rudd was somewhat courting the arts community in a future summit he held some months ago. So there's been quite a big backlash against the federal government over this issue. This has really blown up in the government's face with Kevin Rudd's comments, as you said in your introduction, that the photos were revolting.
Well, and as much as you can and feel comfortable doing, can you describe them for us?
The photos that Bill Henson has been exhibiting since 1975, these sorts of photos, they're very dark. I mean, photos quite often of naked young people, as you say, between the ages of 12 or 16. And his theme, he says, he's exploring, I guess, adolescence, sort of finding out about their sexuality. Quite often the photos show sort of young people who you might assume have been involved in a sexual act, but it's never explicit. I mean, the photos, couldn't say they were pornography, really. I mean, they are sometimes creepy, but I think calling them pornography, it's something of a long bow, I think.
And you say he's been doing these kinds of photos since 75. So why was his exhibit in Sydney shut down just last week? I mean, what triggered that?
There's a prominent anti-child abuse campaigner here in the state of Queensland. She saw the invitation, which featured a photo of a naked 12-year-old girl, and she made a complaint about it. Then it was picked up on the day before the exhibition opened by a very prominent newspaper columnist, and it snowballed from there. That article got a lot of publicity, and I guess the police thought they should go and have a look. Then on that day, the police went to the gallery hours before the exhibition was going to open, and they seized a number of the photographs and indicated that they were quite confident they were going to lay charges under the Obscenity Act. The strange thing is that, as you said, this man has been exhibiting for decades. He's one of Australia's most feted artists. His photographs are in the Guggenheim Collection, in the Bibliothèque Nationale, in Paris, all the major galleries in Australia. One of the ironic things is he had a massive exhibition recently in the Art Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney, where this is all taking place. And images of his were on posters all around the cities and on banners throughout the city. So it's somewhat strange that now his work is being questioned in this way.
Well, here in the U.S., we have the famous comment from a Supreme Court judge. The definition of pornography is that you know it when you see it. But as you said, we've also had debates as to what is pornography, what is art. But what does Australian law say? Are there free speech guarantees in the law? And, are artists saying that this would be under that? Is there a definition of pornography?
Lots of politicians have come out and said that all artists have the right to freedom of expression as long as they stay within the confines of the law. But no one's really spelt that out. Again, the ironic thing is that the High Court of Australia has Bill Henson photographs in its art collection as well.
Well, probably not the pictures of kids, but, again, given that these are pictures of young people, what are the parents of the young people saying?
They've come out and strongly defended Bill Henson. There hasn't been one parent or even an ex-model of Bill Henson's who's so far said that they were disturbed or uncomfortable with the process. There have been several models and their parents now who are sort of older have said that they were quite comfortable and with the whole process and found the images quite beautiful.
That's Hamish Fitzsimmons, a reporter for the 7:30 Report on Australia's ABC television. Well, Hamish, we'll just watch from here in the States to see how it unfolds. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Robert.
And coming up, Texas troubadour Hayes Carl in 1 minute, here and now. At the age of 32, Texas singer-songwriter Hayes Carl has developed quite a following. Stephen King put Carl's Down the Road Tonight on his list of last year's top songs. Well, now Ken Tucker of Entertainment Weekly calls Hayes Carl's new CD, Trouble in Mind, one of the year's best country CDs so far. Here's a little of the first cut, Drunken Poet's Dream. I got a woman, she's wild as wrong. She likes to lay naked and be gazed upon. Well, she crosses a bridge and sets it on fire. Lands like a bird on a telephone wire. That's Drunken Poet's Dream from Hayes Carl's new CD, Trouble in Mind. He does cover some familiar country territory, whiskey, honky-tonks, women. But this is a poet. His lover likes to lay naked and be gazed upon. When was the last time you heard the word upon in a gritty country music song? Hayes Carl is touring through June. He joins us from KUT in Austin, Texas. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we read that you grew up writing poetry, although perhaps as your first cut says, perhaps drunken poetry, and were inspired by Bob Dylan?
Well, the real turning point for me was we used to attend the Unitarian Church, and they're not known for their choirs, but what they did have was they would have performers come in, and one Sunday they had a three-piece folk trio come in and sing Bob Dylan songs. I went home after that, after hearing Blowing in the Wind and A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and told my folks, you know, I want a guitar and I want to learn how to do what I just saw.
Yeah. Well, already that's interesting because I'm trying to think if I know of any other country stars who are UUs who went to Unitarian churches.
Yeah, we're few and far between.
Yeah, and that brings to mind the last cut on your new CD. It's She Left Me for Jesus. Let's hear just a little bit of that. She left me for Jesus, and that just ain't fair. She says that he's perfect. How could I compare? There are points in this song, Hayes, that are laugh out loud. I mean, here's a guy speculating, who's this other guy in his woman's life? I bet he's a commie, or even worse, a Jew. And she yells his name out when they're making love.
He's a little confused.
Well, as reviewers have said, how's this going to go over in Nashville?
I don't know, and I try not to worry about it too much. I was fortunate that I didn't. I started out without a crowd, and it's taken me a long time to kind of develop one of any size, and so I've always kind of written for myself, and you know, I just figure out I make the music that I like to make, and hopefully there's an audience for it. For the most part, not too many people have walked out yet.
Well, you say, you know, taking you a while to develop a crowd. Yeah, you're all of 32, but tell us more. When did you start? Where are you from?
Well, I'm from a suburb outside of Houston, Texas, and went to college in Arkansas. They do have colleges in Arkansas, and I went to one. And then after I got done with that, I moved to a place called Crystal Beach, Texas, which is on a peninsula outside of Galveston. That's where I started really getting my first gigs. I started playing at shrimper bars down there and eventually worked my way around the world. Homer's in the corner breaking up a fight. Good Lord, I hope I get
paid tonight. I got a gig, baby. That's I Got a Gig from Trouble in Mind. And Hayes, you mentioned you grew up in a suburb, at least initially. So, you know, I've been wondering, did you live the life that you sing about in songs like Bad Liver and A Broken Heart, or did you research this life that's sort of the backbone of the country song?
Yeah, I certainly didn't live it growing up. I mean, my mom used to make fun of me, and she'd say, you can't be a country singer. What are you going to sing about the country club being out of towels or something, you know, because I grew up in a planned community that was, you know, there's a lot of golf courses and Mercedes, and it was a perfectly fine town to grow up in. But, you know, once I got the bug of, you know, Dylan and Kerouac and these people that were writing these amazing stories and songs about life that I didn't know anything about, you know, it just grabbed a hold of me, and I realized that I wanted to be able to do that, but that I had absolutely no life experience that I could translate into that. It's girls like this.
lies to keep me trying. She goes off like an earring sound.
What is it about the singing about the drinking in particular? You know, I know what it, you know, does to listeners. It's, you know, fun to listen to, but what does it do to you to sing that?
A lot of the stuff that I write or am drawn to is either autobiographical or things that that I can relate to. And, you know, I wouldn't say I'm proud of it, but, you know, the last 10 or 12 years I've spent my life in bars trying to make a living and you know, enjoying myself for the most part. And, you know, there's just a lot of material to be found in there for me.
There's Knocking Over Whiskeys. Let's listen to that.
I keep knocking over whiskeys. No one's laughing at my jokes. They got me spinning around in circles like a tin can in the spokes. When I left town this morning with a smile upon my face, oh, babe, I swear I never knew I'd end up in this place.
Seems, Hayes, like coupled with the drinking, there are a lot of regrets.
Yeah, that was the thing that grabbed me, was one that people could express through poetry or songs, all the aches and sorrows and joys and wonders of the world. And that's what I wanted to be able to do. I wanted to be able to have that effect on people. And as time goes by, you realize, okay, I'm 21 and I haven't written the Free Will and Bob Dylan record yet, or I'm 25 and I haven't done this, or 30 and I haven't done that. And I remember when I was in high school, they had a creative writing class. I was writing about how my life had passed me by, and I remember my teacher writing on one of my papers, "Do something about it, lest it become true." And I don't know where my obsession with wasting my life comes from, but that's always just been a huge fear of mine, that I was somehow going to, at the end of my days, look back and realize that I had not done the best that I could. So it comes up in the songs a lot.
Now there's a picture on the mantletop, I fill with old regrets. There are things I can't remember and the times I won't forget. I call you up and tell you, but baby, we've been gone too long.
Well, Hayes, you know, you've been talking a lot at 32 about, you know, worrying that you're not accomplishing. You know, it seems like one of your motivations is this fear that you won't, you know, do the things you want to do. Wow, what's going to be your motivation now? You're getting, you know, A ratings and Entertainment Weekly and, you know, Stephen King loves you and you're doing it.
Well, it's it feels good, and every once in a while I have to remind myself that I'm not a total failure. And, you know, I don't want to be complacent about it either. It's I thought a long time ago that I had potential to do something good, and until I feel like I've accomplished that to my standards, and, you know, I don't think I'm going to rest. I still feel like I got a lot left to do.
That's Hayes Carl. His new CD is Trouble in Mind. He's speaking to us from KUT in Austin, Texas. We'll give you more information about his tour at our website, here-now.org. Hayes, thanks so much for speaking to us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
So don't let me fall, so I might not get up again. Just hold me tight right now. I need a friend. I've come too far for this to be the end. Don't let me fall, so I might not get up.